We've lost about 30 to 40% of our microbiome. The consequence is a massive global escalation in non-communicable diseases. So your risk of allergy, asthma, inflammatory bowel disease, bowel cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, these sorts of things are all climbing. And it's young people today that are experiencing the greatest burden of disease. And the problem is that there are no shortcuts to this. If we're really meaningfully invested in solving that problem, we can't solve it by having some kimchi. This is incredibly urgent. We've got to do this now. And if we don't, we will be trapped in a continuing cycle of damage from which there will be no escape.
Well, I mean, that does sound like very high stakes.
Does it look bleak enough for you there, Josh? Is that
it's really bleak. But it's nice that we can come back with the hope at the end.
Yeah.
The human microbiome is a community of microbes that populates our skin, our lungs, our eyes, our entire digestive system. These microbes are central to who we are and to our health. And to be honest, we hear about their significance a lot. But what I haven't heard much about is the fact that they're in crisis and we're losing them. And from the responses we received on our YouTube community call-out, it sounds like you have a lot of questions about this too. So I spoke to Dr. James Kinross, a senior lecturer in colorectal surgery and a consultant surgeon at Imperial College London. He's written a book about this very problem. He talked me through what all this means for our health and what we can do about it, as well as blowing my mind about just how incredible the microbiome is. James, can you explain what is the microbiome?
So a microbiome is a collection of all microscopic life forms and everything that they need to sustain themselves within a niche. And within the body, we've got lots of different types of microbiomes. So microbiomes exist at a very small scale, a very large scale. So we have them throughout the gut. The gut is just a long tube. It goes from the top to the bottom, rather obviously. And your microbiome in your mouth is diverse and quite different to the microbiome in your small bowel or the microbiome in your large bowel and your colon. We also have microbiomes on our skin, in our lungs, in our urogenital tract. And these microbial systems communicate and they're interconnected. Now, they are vast and they're massive and they're hypervariable between people. So to give you a sense, there's about the same number of bacteria in your gut as there are cells in the whole of your body. So at a cellular level, you are as much microbe as you are human. But at a genomic level, you are completely dwarfed by your microbiome. So Josh, there's probably around 25 to 30,000 genes that code proteins that make a Josh. And there's probably about 30 million microbial genes in your body or on your body that come from bacteria that allow you to be healthy and happy. So you are genetically, 1% or less, 1% human. At a cellular level, you're certainly as human as you are microbial. And I tend to think of you as a superorganism. You're like this connected being of lots of different genomes, all vibrant, interacting, communicating in a sort of super dynamic way.
That's amazing, because we often think about our individual kind of genetic code, our DNA, as being our uniqueness. But you're saying it goes far beyond that.
Genetic code is really very boring and not very unique at all. Like you and me, like we share 99.99% of our genes or whatever it is. Like we're different people, but only a small amount of that comes from our genetic variants. Microbes or your microbiome has huge amounts of variants. So you and I, out of the 500 to 1,000 species of bacteria, for example, that live in your gut, you and I will share about 10%. And your microbiome, in terms of its functions and all of the other microscopic life forms that live in there, is almost completely unique to you. And that's super important if you're trying to prevent a disease or treat a disease, because the majority of drugs don't work in the majority of people, not because of our genetics, because the genetics are so similar. Like these tiny variants, these kind of what they call SNPs or these genetic mutants, yes, they do exist, and yes, they can influence, the variants of how drugs work. But actually, the vast majority is because of your microbes, because that's where the majority of your variation is, or our variation is. And if you want to have something called personalized healthcare, which is like the big hype, the big future of healthcare, which means getting the right medicine or treatment into the right person at the right time for the right reasons, and we can use AI and all these other cool technologies to do that, you can't do it without knowledge of the microbiome. You simply cannot do it. So you might take a medicine like paracetamol, if you get a bit of a headache. Well, how you excrete and break down that paracetamol is going to be influenced very significantly by your microbes. If you take any common medicines, they're going to have a big impact.
How are we getting these microbes onto our body, into our body? How do they kind of populate us?
The microbes that are within us and on us are not there by accident. The microbes were on this planet a long time before we got here, and we've co-evolved, and evolutionary biologists have like a long posh word for that, which they call phylosymbiosis. So microbes they've influenced, you know, literally everything about our cell biology through to how our organs develop and our brains develop. And probably, you know, microbes entered the gut about 500 to 600 million years ago for the first time, and they've been there ever since. Not in our gut, obviously. It took a while for Homo sapiens to come around. But when you're born and you're delivered into the world and you pass through your mother's birth canal, that's the first time you kind of come into contact with good abundances of microbes. And that's a very important colonizing event. You might even come into contact with skin flora, so skin microbiota, when you're on your mother's breast. And you begin to, you know, pick up the microbes around you. And then, of course, you start to breastfeed. And when you're being breastfed, there's lots of lovely sugars in breast milk. I mean, breast milk is fascinating in its own right because it's a living tissue and it has lots of important biological functions. But it's got lots of these galacto-oligosaccharides, these sugars, which bugs just love to eat. So milk has its own microbiome. It's got its own microbes that you kind of ingest. But then you get these big super bloom events in the gut as these microbes begin to get all of the nourishment they need, and you get these big populations of bifidobacteria. And then you start to wean and your food diversifies and your gut diversifies with it, and you start to play with your little mates, and maybe you've got a pet in your home, and you know, you go out into the world and your microbiome changes again. And then it's pretty stable from about the age of 5. We think there are other important life events where it might be vulnerable and might shift, like puberty or the menopause in women, but it's pretty stable until you get to adulthood, and you're kind of late adulthood, and you get to later life around the ages of 60 to 70. No one's quite sure when. And then it starts to become more unstable. It starts to shift again. It starts to change.
So, James, can you clear this up? Is it true that we are destroying our microbiome?
Sadly, it is true. And we have very good evidence from lots of studies from around the world that we're missing large parts of our microbiome. So microbes have been going extinct because of recent changes in our antimicrobial strategies, nutrition, diet, globalization. But it's also true that there are winners. So some microbes are disappearing, but others are benefiting, and they also cause harm.
What is the impact of that? What does that mean for our health?
We are living longer than we've ever lived in history, but we're not living happier. We're living with this burden of chronic disease that severely impacts on our quality of life, and it's unaffordable. Our healthcare systems are collapsing because we simply cannot afford to manage it. Our economy suffers because we can't afford to manage it. And we burden people at extremes of life, so young people and old people with this. It's the future generations that are, you know, that are really going to suffer, and it's young people today that are experiencing the greatest burden of disease. So this isn't anything that I feel like we have a particular choice around. This is incredibly urgent. We've got to do this now, and if we don't, we will be trapped in a continuing cycle of damage from which there will be no escape.
Well, I mean, that does sound like very high stakes.
There's that for you there, Josh. Is that?
It's really bleak, but it's nice that we can come back with the hope at the end.
Yeah. Microbes, they don't stay constant. They're always reacting to the environmental stress they're placed under. They're under huge amounts of stress and they are behaving differently. We can go back and look at ancient microbiomes because we can identify them in teeth and we can identify them in coproliths. So these are kind of hard fossilized stools. And what you see is that probably in modern history, we've lost about 30 to 40% of our microbiomes. And the consequences of that is that our organs are developing differently and we're exposed to a different set of communicable, non-communicable diseases that we weren't exposed to, you know, 150 years ago. Now, some of that is diseases of progress, and those diseases of progress, of course, are not completely defined by microbiology, but microbiology is a fundamental component of that story. And unless you understand that, it's very difficult to prevent some of these diseases, because it then follows that actually this sort of rephrasing is, I hope, more positive, because you can do something about it. Like, we all are empowered to do something about it. This is not something that, you know, is beyond us.
That's a good point, I think, to maybe talk about some of those stresses that you mentioned.
microbes have this phenomenal ability to adapt, and they can adapt much faster than we can to stress, right? The microbiome has this big catalogue of enzymes and molecular functions to adjust to environmental insults. And of course, if you're in an urban environment, it's not just microplastics or, you know, pollutions and pollutants in the air. It's lots of other factors, multiple things causing lots of different problems simultaneously. And the way that I'm trying to sort of communicate this is that the microbiome, it sits in the interface between those things. And if you really want to understand how multiple drivers in a complex system cause a disease, you need a different kind of science. You need something called systems biology, and you need to have an understanding of the microbiome, because if you don't, you're missing a really big piece in the puzzle. You're trying to build a model of how a disease gets caused, like cancer, a disease that I study, but there's just this giant missing piece in it, because it literally and figuratively stands between everything that we eat, everything we come into contact with, and our genome.
Is the lifestyle changes that have kind of developed over generations, is that a big contributor to the decline in the microbiome?
It's a massive contributor to a change in the microbiome. The microbiome is passed from parent to infant. It's a sort of, it's a gift that is given to you in early life. And we think about microbes influencing our health through their ability to signal to us. And they can signal to us through this really sophisticated and complicated molecular language. And sometimes it's switched on and some bits of it's switched off. And it's like it's speaking in lots of different dialects constantly. And because of that, it's kind of overwhelming to think about it. So the way that we often describe it is through orchestral signaling. Think of your microbiome playing a symphony, and bits of the orchestra are going to wake up and play loud, and sometimes they'll be quiet, and some of the band won't do anything for a bit, and then it will come back in. What we know is that families who have very large networks, you know, particular cultures that have very, very big families, or who have exposure to animals, their microbiomes are very diverse. They're very, very different, and they don't, or they are less likely to get, you know, immune-mediated diseases, conditions caused by a dysfunctional immune system. They still get diseases of deprivation, and they still have, you know, healthcare problems because of, you know, multiple other social complicated factors, but they just don't get them in the same way. So it's not just that our social network is changing in urban modern environments, it's that our family network is changing. Like, families are getting smaller. You know, society has changed really dramatically in a very short period of time. In just a few thousand years, we've become very urbanized. We've literally taken our hands out of the soil, and we've become socially isolated because although we live in big urban environments where we're surrounded by people, we're not necessarily having meaningful interactions with them. And in fact, loneliness is quite a big problem for modern people. We're exposed to many different environmental pollutants and toxins, and our diets have historically become very, very homogenized. And what that does is it creates a very different environment through which we come into contact with microbes. And in many ways, it kind of homogenizes it, and we lose that diversity. And so what we think is that there's a sort of generational change in the way that microbes are passed from parent to infant, and through which our microbes then colonize us in our lives. And that generational change has been speeding up as we go over the last 60 to 70 years. And the consequence of that is that you have a sort of hyper-global generation of people living in very big environments who just don't have microbial systems optimized for health.
Could you talk a little bit about how antibiotics plays a role in this?
Sure. So antibiotics have, you know, in the industrial age, so since the 1940s when we started to really manufacture them at scale and misuse them at scale, have profoundly reshaped the global microbiome. We've misused them not just in medicine, where obviously we rely on them. I literally couldn't do my job without antibiotics. All my patients would die of sepsis because I'm a surgeon. But we've misused them in farming. By the 1940s, they understood that if you gave antibiotics to farm animals, they gained weight faster. They became fatter. You got them to market weight much faster. And the reason that happens is because you cause inflammation, and it's inflammation that drives insulin resistance. And then, of course, if you then apply that to humans, the same thing occurs. But instead of, you know, feeding them chicken feed, you feed them a globalized Western diet and fast food. Then, you know, you've got no defense against it. So antibiotics have, you know, they've reshaped every single microbial system on the planet. We continue to globally misuse them in farming. We have some regulation, but not enough. We continue to misuse them in medicine, and they are probably the most important driving force that has reshaped microbial ecosystems ever in the history of the planet.
I think there's probably almost every listener or person watching this will have come into contact with antibiotics at some point in their life, even uh-huh. if it was as a baby.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've certainly had an infection and had to treat it or been prescribed antibiotics. So, I mean, you know, from my point of view, I knew that the microbiome, my gut biome is really important. It might be damaging that. And so after the course, you're kind of faced with this, you know, question of what do you do? How do I repair this? What damage have I done? What can I do about it?
So, I mean, so I have to wear my doctor hat when I sort of talk about these things, because I'm not anti-antibiotics. Like I said, I prescribe them like regularly, and they're very, very important. And if you're sick and you've got a pathogen and you've got a bad bug that's going to cause you harm, then you need to take one. And there's no problem with that. You should take one. But what I am saying is that what we should really be doing is thinking a little differently about how we might want to treat microbial ecosystems within us. We're sort of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. What we're doing is we're killing all microbial life forms, which have lots of really important roles and functions in the gut, to kill one single strain. So we don't have any precision in the tools that we use, and the consequence is ecological collapse in a gut system, which might have very long-lasting implications in other aspects of your health, which we don't really consider.
What can we do as individuals if we're worried about our microbiome? And there's so much advice out there in terms of diet, you know, wellness videos and all sorts of things on social media, probiotics, prebiotics. You kind of scramble for all these things, kimchi, yogurts, you know, kombucha. Yeah. Are these things on offer to us? Are they helpful? Is there a gap of understanding there that we need to fill?
So my top tip to anybody listening to this, if you're sick and you're taking antibiotics, just don't feel guilty or waste any time worrying about your microbiome, and think much more about how lucky you are to have the antibiotic, because we're not going to have them forever at this rate. And with resistance rates climbing, that's going to be a really big problem. So, you know, if you're sick and you need it, just take it and don't worry about it. The likelihood is if you're taking a penicillin, or, you know, what I would call a narrow spectrum, you know, antibiotic, actually the impact on the microbiome is likely to be transitory and quite short lasting, and it's most likely it will come back and you'll be okay. And actually, a microbiome is tremendously resilient. It's pretty tough. It's quite hard to really break it, because it's an ecosystem, and a healthy microbiome will have lots of diversity and it can adjust and it can regrow. The problem comes back down to the definition of the microbiome that I gave you at the beginning, which I said it has, you know, a context and time dependent shift. It moves. So if you're doing giving antibiotic therapy in early life or in pregnancy, the potential impact is going to be much, much greater. And if you're giving it in later life, if you're older, it's going to be very, very different. Also, it depends on the type of antibiotic and also the number of doses that you're having. So if you're having recurrent doses of very broad spectrum antibiotics in early life, then the impact is very plainly going to be much, much different to you having a bit of a, you know, microbacterial chest infection and you know, getting antibiotics in your 30s, 40s, 50s or 60s. And again, the good news is that there are absolutely things that you can do. So the first thing that you can do is you can say to your doctor, "Hey, doc, thank you for giving me these antibiotics. Can you please culture me to make sure that I'm on the right ones? And can you also make sure that I'm on the most specific antibiotic that I need? And that if I'm going to take my antibiotic, I complete that course?" Because those are good things to do. You might be able to measure your microbiome so you know what it was before. And you might be able to then use a slightly targeted way to get it back to where it needs to be. And I do advocate measuring microbiomes, and probably should only really be doing it with a doctor who knows what they're talking about, because I think consumer testing is quite hard. But what you absolutely shouldn't be doing in that instance is drinking sugary drinks like Lucozade. That is an absolute no. Like fast foods, ultra processed foods, alcohol, that's all got to stop. You really should be moving towards a plant-based diet. So a high fiber plant-based diet. You really should be staying, you know, well hydrated. You should be, I think, supplementing your diet in that instance with a little bit of either a prebiotic or a probiotic. There's actually pretty good evidence for that, for both of those things. A prebiotic is a complex sugar, which is selectively broken down by bugs and it has a health benefit. A probiotic is a live bacteria that has an established health benefit. And if you take a multi-strain probiotic with, you know, a reasonable dose, actually that will prevent you from having nasty side effects from the antibiotic. And it's a good idea. Prebiotic is a good idea.
So it does matter what you eat, and it does matter kind of when, at what point in your life you're eating certain things. Is that correct?
For sure. So if you're an infant, you may not have that much choice, really. But we know that breastfeeding is really, really important for the developing microbiome. So the longer children are breastfed, you know, the more resilient and healthy their microbiome. So that, you know, there are lots of really good health data from around the world to show benefit of breastfeeding to infant and mother. Like, it's a really good thing. I appreciate that some women can't do it, and that's fair enough. And there might be good reasons why you can't. And again, don't feel guilty if you can't breastfeed. But we do know that babies who are formula fed have different microbes in their gut, and they have more pro-inflammatory microbes in their gut, and they can be quite resilient and difficult to shake. We do know that, again, really super common sense stuff. Westernized diets, so diets high in fat, high in refined sugars, high in salt and animal protein, and low in fiber, have a very, very different effect on the microbiome than a high fiber, low fat, low animal fat diet. And that these diets can really profoundly change the microbiome and its functions within a very short period of time. So de-westernizing your diet, diversifying your diet, and having a plant-based fiber, high fiber diet is an extremely simple and very, very effective way for improving almost all aspects of your health. And the microbiome is an important reason as to why that works so effectively. We do know that part of the reasons why foods like ultra-processed foods are so harmful is because of microbes. So microbes either break down these molecules and turn them into things that can cause harm, or they change the diversity of the microbiome, or they change the function of the microbiome. And there's sort of the missing piece in the UPF story. We do know that fermented foods have quite a big impact on the microbiome, in that they, if you're taking a high fiber diet, for example, and you supplement it with a fermented diet, with fermented food, it will change the diversity in a good way, and it's very helpful. And I sort of highly, highly recommend that. But actually with diet, what you do find is that because most people's diets are pretty stable over a long period of time, actually the microbiome is also pretty stable with it. So you've got to make quite significant changes to the diet to really make that shift.
So it's broader changes to your diet that's needed, and not just having, say, a bit more kimchi or a bit more kombucha.
Well, look, I love kimchi and kombucha. I think the thing is that if you're going to have foods that have got sort of probiotic strains in them, or they've got, you know, prebiotic functions, you've got to take them quite regularly, and you've got to eat them every day, because you're engrafting those microbes into your gut, and that's got to be done consistently. So having a spoonful of kimchi every couple of weeks isn't really going to change your microbiome at all. Like, you've got to do these things. It's got to be part of your behavior change, right? It's got to be a sustained change that you make in your diet. But again, the sort of issue around, you know, rephrasing this as a climate change is that what we're saying is that it's much, much better just to not damage it in the first place, right? So yes, diet can repair some of the damage. Yes, diet is an important part of regulating its function, but diet doesn't happen in isolation. And I think this is often forgotten in the way that this issue is communicated. So if you look at studies on antibiotic consumption and food, like, they have a profound and important interaction. So if you take antibiotics and then you take a westernized diet, the damage done to the gut through unregulated inflammation is significantly greater. It significantly impacts the effect that those antibiotics have, so their clinical efficacy, how they work, and your risk of side effects. And of course, if antibiotics are endemic in our foods and water supplies and in our urban environments, and and we are having a bad diet, then these two things interact, and that has a profound effect.
There's also been a big rise in kind of advocating for higher protein diets. I know certainly in young people, it's a big craze in having high protein diets at the moment. Is that having an impact on the microbiome?
It does have an impact. It does. I mean, your gut is in its kind of most basic sort of description, your colon, your large bowel, is basically a giant fermenting engine. And that's where the majority of the microbes are. And it will metabolize and ferment proteins. That's what it does. And when you ferment proteins, you break them down into their individual amino acids. Some of those amino acids can be very good and very healthy, and some of them are not. They're very toxic. Of course, if you're having plant-based proteins, that's very different to having animal-based proteins. And of course, there's very big differences on the microbiome if you're having protein powders or amino acid powders versus, having, structured meats and foods that you're taking with a food matrix. And yeah, these things have, not a great impact on the microbiome, actually. And it's really bad for your gut. So young, I've got a son. That's exactly what he's about 16. That's what he loves to do is, dad, I want to go for the gains. I'm eating for the gains. And he's really cross because I won't let him take creatine. I'm like, there's just no way you're putting that into your gut. It's not good to be consuming these powders. And it's pro-inflammatory, basically. So what you really want is, like anything, there are no shortcuts to this. Biohacking, if you're biohacking, to make a radical change in your body shape, it's very likely that your microbiome is going to be unhappy about it, basically. And I know this because we've also done studies looking at rugby players. So we've done a bunch of dietary intervention studies, and then we've measured what happens to the microbiome in an elite athlete. So people who gain a lot of muscle and a lot of weight who do exactly what you've just described. And in many ways, these people are extremely healthy. Like, they have extraordinary athletic capacity, very, very strong. But their microbiomes are churning out TMAO and lots of these kind of molecules that probably have much longer term consequences for their health, but they're just not measuring and they're not thinking about. And actually, your gut is like this. It's like a, like we've described, it's this kind of fabulously important ecosystem. It needs to be nourished and looked after a little bit. You're not just eating for you, you're eating for your microbes, and you need to think about them a little bit.
Is there a connection to the rise in, say, bowel cancer in young people?
It's a very good question. Bowel cancer's, the second commonest cause of cancer-related death worldwide. And, we get in this country, we get about 45,000 new cases a year. And what's troubling is that if you're a millennial or you're born, even after that, your risk of bowel cancer is now climbing very dramatically. So your risk of bowel cancer is now four times someone who was born in the 1950s or 60s or 70s. So it's climbing very, very dramatically. And we don't know why. And this is a global problem, and it's a global problem that's replicated in lots of different countries. And there are lots of theories as to why it's happening. And I would say two things about it. The first is that you can't look at single diseases like this in isolation. So if you want to understand that, you have to understand, well, lots of other diseases are rising at an alarming rate in young people, right? So a lot of immune-mediated diseases are rising. So your risk of allergy, asthma, ATP, inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, these sorts of things are all climbing. And we're also seeing a rise in obesity, insulin resistance, cardiometabolic diseases. And we're also seeing a rise in mental health problems. And, we are seeing, it's hugely controversial and tricky to talk about, but we are seeing rising rates in neurodevelopmental diseases, in autism spectrum condition. And then we're seeing rises in neurodegenerative conditions at the other end of that spectrum. So the question then becomes, well, is cancer different, or is there a common thing that's driving all of these things? And that's where I think the microbiome is important, because I think it is part of the story that explains all of these things, because it's got such a broad set of functions. It can be involved in seemingly unrelated conditions simultaneously. So to piece it together, to try and give you a kind of coherent explanation, I think you need to understand two things. The first is that if you want to understand most non-communicable diseases, so diseases that are not caused by a pathogen that's passed from one person to another, like tuberculosis, this is like a condition like cardiovascular disease, you have to understand that the thing that causes it is that it's kind of multifactorial. So there might be genetic predisposition to it, of course, but it's also certainly going to be something in your environment. So something that you eat, something that you smoke, something that, you're exposed to. and it's your microbes, right? Definitely. And I call that gene exposome microbiome interactions or GEM interactions, right? So, and if you don't understand one of those three things, you can't have the whole picture to explain why a disease is changing. My summary explanation of this is that the reason you're seeing rising rates is because of that internal climate crisis. And because you're seeing a rapid generational change in that orchestral signaling across hyperglobal generations, and the consequences of massive global escalation in non-communicable diseases, and cancer is the end result of it.
Wow. So those are the kind of really high stakes of trying to tackle this internal climate crisis.
Yeah. And the problem is that there are no shortcuts to this. So, and again, that's why I phrase it like a climate crisis. Like, if we're really meaningfully invested in solving that problem, we can't solve it by having some kimchi, right? So, which is why I was sort of saying before, like, yeah, kimchi's great. You should have kimchi. It's good for your gut. And I really like it. And it's tasty and it's good for you. But it doesn't solve a generational problem, which is multifactorial in its causation, right? So the only way you can solve that is to think about solving the problem the same way you would solve an external climate crisis. And there are things we can all do to solve that, right? And you can borrow examples from that when you talk about your health or our health.
And so that's a societal level thing. So that's, does government have a big role to play here with public health? Are there policies shifts we can make?
It's super unsexy and unexciting. Okay. Like, we just want to talk about, are you taking, you know, cool pills that look great? But, and it is the least exciting, most boring thing. But, and you know, policy wonks argue about the impact of health policy, you know, but I do think that regulation is really important. So the gift of the microbiome is that it explains why so many of the things that we've known about for so long cause bad healthcare problems. It explains the mechanism. And therefore, it should empower people to make legislation that protects people, because we've got a better understanding of the science, right? And the gift of the microbiome is 100% in prevention. It's about understanding, you know, that you can change it. And if you change it in meaningful moments in your life, actually the long-term implications are really important and potentially very, very beneficial.
Coming off the back of what you just said, are there things going on at the moment in microbiome science that give you hope?
Oh, yeah, I'm full of hope. Like, I'm really positive. There's never been but genuinely a more exciting time to be in science. If you're young and you're listening to this and you're thinking, I want to get into science, like, now is the time. We're on the cusp of solving, like, some of the most fundamental problems in human biology and biology full stop. And the gift, like, the microbiome is a massive gift. Like, we've understood this phenomenal system complexity, and we've now got the tools to begin to understand it, right? So, and I think microbiome science has suffered a little bit because it's been very overhyped. It kind of was a new science. It was one of the first new big sciences to grow up in the age of social media. And the expectation has been very, very high. But because of its complexity, two things have happened. The first is that it's very easy to manipulate it or misuse that science to sell a product, or to make a social media claim that is basically, we have a term for this in microbiome science, is basically bullshit, right? And there's just a lot of bullshit. And that's really damaging to microbiome science, because it raises the level of hope, but actually we're trying to solve really, really super complicated problems. And actually the microbiome, for all of its impact, is nuanced and subtle. Like, you can't just switch it on here and switch it on there, which is why we do fecal transplants, because it's so complicated. The only thing that we can do in some instances is just give people a whole new set of microbes, because we can't target it. But also, we're generating now really exciting new cool tools to solve these problems, right? So, for example, we're falling back in love with phage. So phage are viruses that infect bacteria. They are sometimes described as the kingmaker of microbial ecosystems, because you know, they define how bacteria live and survive. They recycle all bacterial life on Earth every 48 hours, and in your gut they're there, and on your skin they're there everywhere, and we can engineer them. We can begin to get them to target. We can attach drugs to them. We can attach, molecules to them that are very bioactive. We can begin to engineer bacteria to deliver drugs, to target disease, to prevent disease. We can create microbiome-targeted diets. We can create foods that actually selectively target the microbiome. We can improve soil health. We can improve the way we farm. We can reduce our burden on antimicrobials. We can create new antimicrobials that are completely targeted. And we can redefine our relationship with the planet through microbes. So the potential is absolutely massive. I'm excited about it. The thing that depresses me is not microbiome science. It's the fact that actually, as a society, we're less interested in really solving the underlying problem. We say, yeah, no, just take a shortcut. What microbiome says is no, like, we know why this is happening. We've known about this since the 1940s, and there's something that we can do about it to prevent this. And we should be able to, you know, use that information in a more impactful way. We should be able to change the behavior of corporations that, you know, that do so much damage to this precious, you know, ecosystem within us, and hold them accountable for it. So no, like, I feel optimistic about it, and I hope your listeners do too.
That's a great note to end on, James. Before we do end, I wanted to ask you if there's one thing you'd want anyone watching this to come away with.
Yeah,
what one thing would you want them to remember from their kind of, you know, this delving into the world of microbiome?
So I would like you to treat your microbiome like you treat your garden, if you have one, or a plant, if you have one. Stop thinking about microbes like you would think about like a drug or a medicine. Like, they're not temporary. They are a living, breathing ecosystem, and they need some love. I would like you to take away from this that you need to love your microbes, and that means they need patience and time. You can't just change your diet and expect your microbes to flick over in 2 weeks and suddenly all of your problems to go away. In the same way, your garden needs sometimes months or many seasons to make those changes, it's the same principle. They need time, and they need love, and they need patience. And if you can't do that, just eat more fiber. That's all you got to do. 7 more grams of fiber a day, everything will get better.
That's great. I mean, often these are quite depressing chats, but this has actually turned into a really hopeful one. So yeah, thanks for that, James.
I hope so.
We could have talked for hours, but you don't have time. You're a doctor. So I'm going to let you go and do your important work.
Oh, listen, Josh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm not going to do anything too important, though.
Fair enough.
Live by the screen.
It's important to relax as well.
Yeah, good.
Cheers. All right, mate. I'll take care.
Cheers, bye.